You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of September, 2012, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Nancy Durham. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll talk with Nina Bakri, widow of Anthony Shadid, who died in Syria while on assignment for the New York Times in February. And with an £8 billion boost, it looks as if London's iconic Battersea Power Station is coming back to life.
The power station itself is a significant icon for London. It's something that is really important in the signature of this city globally. And we want to build on that in terms of creating a place, a destination, a mixed-use centre based around the power station.
In India, there's a move afoot to pay women for their housework. We'll check in on the Toronto International Film Festival, which kicks off tomorrow. And of course, we'll play some music too, all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. First, let's catch up on the news with Jonathan Wheatley.
More than 3,000 striking South African miners marched through the streets near Lonmin's Marikana mine today, the largest protest at the hotspot since police shot dead 34 of their colleagues last month. Police, armed with tear gas and assault rifles, deployed armoured vehicles and helicopters to keep an eye on these stick-waving protesters. Methodist church priest Paul Varian said the demands of the miners were reasonable.
Barbed wire, on your knees, pleading for reasonable working hours, for reasonable pay. I actually think, by comparison to what some people in this mine are earning and some of the investors are earning from what is coming from this mine, 12.5 is reasonable, if I must be absolutely honest with you.
The newly elected Quebec Premier Pauline Marois has been rushed off stage after a masked gunman shot one person dead inside a Montreal theatre where the leader of Quebec's separatist Parti Québécois was celebrating a narrow election win in the Canadian province. She later returned to finish her speech. The shooting eclipsed news that the Parti Québécois had pipped the ruling Liberals in Tuesday's election and would have to be content with a minority government, effectively ruling out another referendum on breaking away from Canada. Democrats in Charlotte, North Carolina, began the second day of the Democratic National Convention today, excited about their message. Last night, delegates were enthused by a speech delivered by the First Lady Michelle Obama that urged voters to give her husband 4 more years to fix the struggling U.S. economy. People on the streets of Charlotte near the venue were upbeat about how the convention was going. Gail Moran and William Gordner said the quality of the speeches was very high.
I thought yesterday's message was great, and I look forward to Bill Clinton tonight and the president on Thursday.
If it hasn't been done yet, this convention is not going to knock anything out of the park, in my opinion. I just think that Michelle was awesome last night, Castro was awesome last night, and I think the other speakers just need to toe the line and maintain that same level of enthusiasm, and it's going to be okay.
An Egyptian lawyer whose arrest in Saudi Arabia in April triggered a diplomatic spat between Cairo and Riyadh has denied charges of drug smuggling at a court hearing today. Ahmed El-Gawazi was arrested for alleged drug possession upon his arrival at Jeddah Airport in April. That touched off angry protests outside the Saudi embassy in Cairo, with almost 1,000 people hurling insults at the kingdom's rulers. Here, the British Prime Minister David Cameron has returned to the dispatch box today in the House of Commons for the first time since the summer recess, and just a day after finalising a reshuffle of his top ministers, saying that the new term would gear everything towards Britain's sluggish economy. After the traditional acknowledgement of those British soldiers who've lost their lives in service to the country since the last Prime Minister's questions, Cameron began the session by praising the efforts of everyone involved in the Olympic and Paralympics here in London.
I want to send all our congratulations to the superb performance of Britain's athletes and Paralympians. I want to say a huge thank you to the volunteers who put such a smiling face on these games, and a large well done to all of the organisers. I think they made the entire country proud, and as they promised, they have indeed inspired a generation.
And finally, McDonald's is to open restaurants close to two holy sites, but the fast food chain has avoided the problem of trying to sell burgers in a place where cows are sacred. The outlets near the Hindu shrine of Vaishno Devi in Katra and the Golden Temple in Amritsar will be vegetarian. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you for that, Jonathan. It's 5 minutes past the hour, and you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozhalovat, Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Dette Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det her Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
New York Times correspondent Anthony Shadid's last book, House of Stone, has just been published in the UK. Shadid died after an asthma attack as he tried to leave Syria in February. Over the past several years, when the American-born Shadid was not reporting from war zones across the Middle East, he spent time in Lebanon rebuilding his great-grandfather's home. House of Stone tells that story. Anthony Shadid's widow, Nada Bakri, who herself reports for the New York Times, joins us on the telephone line now. Good evening to you, Nada.
Good evening.
You are in London to help publicize and, I guess, celebrate the publication of your husband's book.
I am, yes. I got here the day before, and we had an event yesterday. To launch the UK edition.
And you've had a bit of practice because I know it came out in March, just weeks after your big loss. So I guess, you know, you're having some time now to get accustomed in one sense, but so little time has gone by. How is it for you putting the book out there on your own?
You know, it was very hard. He just worked on this book for a very long time, and it meant so much to him, and he was really looking forward to seeing it published. And he was scheduled to go on a 9-city tour in America, and then other tours in other places, in other countries. And then he died right before the book was published. So I felt like I had to do whatever I can to market the book. And it was very hard in the beginning because he had just passed away, and the book came out, and I had to do everything. Because he would have wanted the book to be read and to be marketed well.
And I've heard you both talk, that is, on the video that's we have access to through the web, of course, both of you talk about the journalist's passion for telling the story. And it was really moving to hear you talk on television about his huge passion and indeed excitement. He was telling you he was gathering the story of his life when he was in Syria. You had those brief phone calls on his last assignment there. And now Syria is so very much and so sadly in the news in the way that it is. Are you able to carry forward his story, his reporting, in some sense, even though he wasn't able to tell those last stories?
You know, I haven't. I haven't actually worked since he passed away. He did tell me from Syria that, it was probably the best reporting trip of his life, that he had five notebooks full of notes from cover to cover, and that he couldn't wait to get out of Syria to write them because he didn't want to write them from there, deeming it too dangerous. I have the notebooks, but I haven't really gone through them yet. Or read, and it's just it's still a little bit painful, and I don't know, to be honest with you, what I'm going to do with them. If I'll write them into some kind of a story or something like that, I'm not sure yet. And no, I haven't gone back to work either, or reported on Syria either since. It's kind of hard still.
I'm sure, and as you say, you've got those notes, and there'll be a time for them. Let's talk about the book. I'm sorry to say I wasn't able to have a copy in front of me today, but I've been reading about it, it's getting wonderful reviews. There he was, and since 2006, I gather, returning to the family home, although he was American-born, the family home, his great-grandfather's home was in Lebanon, and he was rebuilding it with great passion and sense of humor, I think, and it was a great challenge. Can you tell us why he decided to do that?
You know, I think always in ever since he was a young man, he wanted to go back to his ancestors' village and find their house. And he heard so many stories about the house, about his, you know, where his great-grandmother was living and where she died and where his grandmother was born. And so finally he made it in 2006 after the war, after the war between Israel and Hezbollah. And he saw the house, it was in a really bad shape. And, you know, I guess the minute he saw it, he just felt like he had to restore it to what it was once. And he started, and he had really great, you know, great visions for the house, and he was very enthusiastic and, you know, maybe sometimes a little bit naive because he didn't quite fully understand, you know, how foremen and workers and builders mm-hmm. worked in this town in southern Lebanon. So that was frustrating for him. But, you know, all in all, it was he had a great year rebuilding it. And, you know, through the house and through his year there, he, after so many years covering wars and bloodshed, it was sort of a very quiet down for him where he, you know, could refind himself. So the house is itself at, you know, restoration of the house, you know, looking for himself or reaching within himself or, you know, for or looking for salvation within through this rebuilding process.
And also I wonder, because I get a sense from reading what people are saying, that in some way, almost metaphorically, he was restoring his country, too, trying to anyway.
Well, I wouldn't say his country. I'd say restoring the Middle East. You know, he longed for the Middle East, you know, the 1930s and 40s or 50s when it was a cosmopolitan place and it was open, when it was prosperous. He longed for the Middle East during the Ottoman era, too, when it was, you know, very powerful before the World War One and all that. And, you know, he longed for this so much that he tried to the house to bring some of that, or some, you know, what he had read or seen in pictures or heard from others, to bring some of that into the house so that the house itself would resemble that Middle East that he longed for, even though he's never, you know, lived in it. Or so, for example, he restored all the arches that are very typical of houses built in that era, and they, you know, are very representative of that time. He restored the original tiles, and then when he couldn't, in the rooms where he couldn't restore the tiles, he looked around everywhere in Beirut where he can find them, and he did. And, you know, the tiles to him was the most, the element that most represented that Middle East that he longed for and that I'm talking about.
So he must have had a lot of satisfaction from that.
From the tile, oh my God, a lot of it. He would just, you know, sit and just stare at the tile for a long time and just be very happy.
Wow. Yeah. Well, it's wonderful to hear you, and I think it's terrific that you're carrying around his word. And I think you're at the Frontline Club tonight, are you?
I am, yes.
I wish you well. I'm sure you'll have a very warm welcome there. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. Nada Bakri, a reporter with the New York Times, and the widow of the late Anthony Shadid.
Monocle 24 is growing. We're proud to introduce The Stack, a new program on air every Saturday. This lively one-hour show is a celebration of the print media, exploring the best in periodicals, niche journals, and newspapers, and talking to people from around the world who are pushing the sector forward and shaping the media landscape. Running on Saturdays at 10 a.m. UK time and repeated on Sundays, the show is an intimate conversation around a coffee table stacked with interesting magazines and newspapers from around the globe, hosted by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brûlé. That's The Stack, every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. UK time, repeated on Sundays and available online. Brought to you in association with J.Crew.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in. From Barenna jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
And you are listening to Midori House. Well, it's been in ruins for almost 30 years, but now it looks as if the iconic Battersea Power Station might finally be on the road to regeneration. An £8 billion redevelopment project promises to create more than 26,000 jobs and relaunch Battersea with an array of residential and commercial buildings by 2016. This morning, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco took in some breathtaking views of the power station.
I am Dr. Michael Oon. I am literally on top of the Battersea Power Station. It is so wonderful that you can actually see Crystal Palace at one end. At the other end, you can see central London. And on the other end, you can see Wembley Stadium. But it's just the thought of this building hasn't been operational for 30 years. I'm on top of it, and I can see all these wonderful sights. And I know that a development is going to start soon.
No London skyline is complete without the prominent Battersea Power Station.
Battersea Power Station is a quintessential part of London and a space unto itself, unlike any other. For the past 40 years, it's been a backdrop for unforgettable films and dramatic images. A unique stage for electrifying events and talents from all corners of the globe.
It's been derelict for years, but finally there are plans for the station to become an active part of the city again.
Battersea Power Station will become a new energy for London, buzzing with creative power that will bind together new homes, workplaces, event areas, shopping and leisure. State-of-the-art office areas will accommodate a workforce of over 10,000. 3,500 modern apartments will be home to nearly 10,000 new residents. The prestigious Central London location will attract both boutique and international stores, while hotel, conference, exhibition and other leisure facilities will draw visitors from around the world.
My name is Rob Tinknell. I'm the CEO of the Battersea Power Station Development Company. The development has a total end value of about £8 billion, and it's an exciting mix of not just residential, but new shops, leisure, restaurants and bars, cafes, event spaces, all combining together to form a new town centre for London.
It's going to be retail, there's going to be residential in there, there's going to be commercial and office space, so it's a true mixed-use building. My name's Ian Simpson. I'm founder and director of Ian Simpson Architects in Manchester and London. The first phase, which I'm involved in, is primarily residential development of a whole variety of sizes of apartments and about 110,000 square feet of mixed use at ground floor, restaurants, bars, a small theatre, workshop office spaces, community spaces, hopefully amenities for the location as well. So the ground floor is a true bit of a city.
It is also serving the local area with green spaces and environmental sustainability.
And the city will enjoy a magnificent new park, 6 acres buzzing with events and activity, perched right on the banks of the River Thames. Battersea Power Station, a symbol of industrial Britain, will once again produce power. However, this time it will be green energy, becoming the largest carbon-neutral building in the world.
So what kind of housing the development will provide?
It's going to be a whole mixture, from studios through to penthouses, we've got townhouses and affordable housing. So the aim is to have a complete mixed community here at Battersea Power Station.
The apartments themselves are very much based around the price range that is currently being set within Nine Elms for other developments adjacent, such as St James's Riverlight and Ballymore scheme, Embassy Gardens. But I think we're a much better scheme than that. I think architecturally we'll be much stronger. We'll have much more beautiful spaces with views of the river, with lots of natural light, courtyard gardens, good quality residential, larger than average size apartments as well, generally. So a lot of them have rooftop terraces and nearly all of them have winter gardens as well. So we think ultimately, whilst they are relatively high-end, they're not any higher in value terms than other developments in the area, but we think they'll be much more attractive than all the other developments in Nine Elms.
But sadly, the most iconic part of the station will not survive, the original chimneys.
The reality is that they're not safe at the moment. So we need to be repaired, and the most economic and respectful way of repairing them is to rebuild them. And the idea is that they'd take one chimney down and rebuild it and then start the next one. But the key thing is that the chimneys are a fundamental part of the iconic value of Battersea Power Station. So they will remain, it's just they've got to be made safe. And that's the only way to do it. The power station itself is a significant icon for London. It's something that is really important in the signature of this city globally. And we want to build on that in terms of creating a place, a destination, a mixed-use centre based around the power station. So to us, it's a great flagship for the development.
For Londoners, it's about finally making this a reality, restoring the power station, this building that's hugely loved. Whether you're interested in real estate or not, everybody loves Battersea Power Station, and we intend on making it a reality.
It's 15 years before we expect the completion of the project, but for now, we can enjoy the view and imagine the changes. For Monaco, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And great, after a nice follow-on now to Fernando's lovely report, Hugo MacDonald, our design editor, is in with me. Hi.
Hello, Nancy.
And I'm here with all kinds of images in my head. And we've got a great big fat picture of this wonderful beast.
We do, don't we? A beast is very appropriate. It's the biggest brick building in Europe, did you know?
No, I didn't.
No, I know.
Oh, you're so good.
No, it looms incredibly large in popular culture, obviously. I think people associate it with the Beatles' Help video and the Pink Floyd album cover. I think maybe that's been part of the problem, why it's lain sort of unloved for such a long time. Obviously, money has been the principal problem.
Because it's a massive Hulk thing? Or
exactly, and
emblem?
It's a power station. It's much easier to turn a power station into an art gallery than it is into a mixed-use residential development.
Living, working, yeah.
Totally, and until now, nobody's really had the funds to be able to invest in it.
And when you look at that Hulk, I mean, is there anybody, somebody out there won't know, it is this massive pile of brown bricks with four huge smokestacks,
exactly.
White, sticking up into
like
the air.
Like an upturned table.
Table, exactly.
Probably the best way of
it's an upturned
it,
table, and just massive.
Yeah.
After they do all these things to it, do you think it's still going to look wonderful like
well,
that?
Well, the sadness is that the chimneys are in such a state of disrepair, as we heard there, that they do have to take them down. But if they're taking them down to then be able to create this incredible mixed-use development that the Malaysians want to, then, you know, maybe it is worth letting the chimneys go rather than just keeping them up there, sort of just held together with sellotape and scaffolding.
Just for show, because he's going to work in one or live in one.
Exactly.
And somebody probably.
I mean, for as long as I've been coming to London, I've been walking past it and just thinking, my goodness, you know, what could be in there? And of the various schemes that have been sort of floated around over the last 30 years, Alton Towers, which is a massive theme park outside London, we're involved in one to potentially turn it into a great big indoor theme park based around Britain's industrial history.
Oh.
Lovely, very imaginative, maybe not sort of the best use of space and such prime space in the heart of London. And then ever since, it has been sort of mixed use developments with very unfortunate sort of sticky financial endings that haven't come to anything. So it's difficult to hear the Malaysians talking about it as if it is, you know, a done deal and this will go ahead. I think everybody wants to believe that it will. I wonder, 50 years from now, whether we will be sending letters with Battersea Power Station addresses on them.
What sort of hitches do you think there might be? Or what would be your major worry?
The state of the building itself is in very bad, bad nick. And this tends to be a big stumbling block that people come in with plans and then realise that it's going to cost so much more than they
Not 8 billion, but 16 billion.
But 16 billion, exactly. And given the scale of the project and how much needs to be gutted, made safe and then redeveloped, you know, you really are not starting from scratch. You have to go so much further back to preserve what's there and make it structurally safe to then be able to build on it. You know, all sorts of companies come and go, and as we've seen in the latest sort of recession, and it was the Irish company that were the latest foolishly forgotten off the top of my head what their name was, but they were the latest owners who just couldn't afford to do what needed to be done.
So it's been handed from...
It's been handed pretty much to... Well, everybody comes in with the same big ambitions and, you know, one by one they go away with their tail between their legs.
Is the government in there too? Did I miss that or did... That came out in the report.
The Malaysian government is involved.
Oh, I meant the British government. Is there any UK?
No, as far as I'm aware, no.
One of the phrases was a new town centre for London.
Mm.
Could you imagine that?
I can. I think this is the other big change and difference that's happened since the last sort of redevelopment plans were unveiled, is that a lot of the infrastructure in that area has properly been sort of brought up to scratch. There's a new tube station opening, there's a lot more housing, a lot more shops. It's become a little bit of a sort of urban hub in itself around the power station without actually including the power station at the moment. So it sort of feels like everything is in place a little bit more than it has been in the past.
Have you been inside it? Much of it?
I have, actually. Yes. I went to a 21st birthday party that was themed Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Was it a rave?
It turned into a very messy, chocolatey rave. There is a room in there that you can hire out for parties and things. That's as close as I've got. I haven't sort of been into the cavernous underbelly of it. And I certainly haven't been up to see the view that Fernando saw today.
So he was up one of these...
He was up on top of one of the chimneys, was he? Yes, in the control room, he's waving.
He's waving, yes. I think he deserves a medal for that, don't you? You wouldn't get me in there.
I think so. Another imaginative plan was to have a one-table restaurant at the top of one of the chimney stacks. Fanciful idea, but maybe logistically a little bit tricky.
And your waiter over on the next chimney stack.
Exactly.
Hello, could you come back to us?
Send me my starter on a zip wire, please. No, but I mean, this seems very plausible. And as long as the money doesn't run out,
okay.
Fingers crossed.
We'll watch this space and hope to see something in 4 years' time.
Indeed.
If we're lucky, that's the date. Okay, Hugo MacDonald, our design editor, thank you very much for popping in. I promised a little music at the top of the show, and here you go. This is the Noisettes with Winner. That was the Noisettes, and Winner. In the next half hour of the program, is it payday for housewives in India? A newly proposed bill suggests husbands pay their wives for taking care of the home. We also cross over to Toronto to get a sneak peek of the Toronto Film Festival. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much, Nancy. More than 3,000 striking South African miners marched through the streets near Lonmin's Marikana mine today, the largest protest at the hotspot since police shot dead 34 of their colleagues last month. Police armed with tear gas and assault rifles deployed armoured vehicles and helicopters to keep an eye on the stick-waving protesters. The newly elected Quebec Premier, Pauline Marois, has been rushed off stage after a masked gunman shot one person dead inside a Montreal theatre where the leader of Quebec's separatist party Quebecois was celebrating a very narrow election win in the Canadian province. She later returned to finish her speech. Democrats in Charlotte, North Carolina, have begun the second day of the Democratic National Convention, excited about their message. Last night, delegates were enthused by a speech delivered by the First Lady Michelle Obama, urging voters to give her husband 4 more years to fix the struggling US economy. An Egyptian lawyer whose arrest in Saudi Arabia in April triggered a diplomatic spat between Cairo and Riyadh has denied charges of drug smuggling at a court hearing today. He was arrested for alleged drug possession upon his arrival at Jeddah Airport in April. And here, the British Prime Minister David Cameron has returned to the dispatch box today in the House of Commons for the first time since the summer recess and just a day after finalising a reshuffle of his top ministers, saying that the new team would gear everything towards Britain's sluggish economy. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monaco 24.
Esse Monaco 24.
Das ist Monaco 24.
And Monaco 24 tagat ja.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Monaco 24 ja jokossa.
Tämä on Monaco 24.
The Pro Pajala
Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Well, as Jonathan just mentioned in his newscast, there was a big shock last night in Montreal when a gunman fired on separatist Parti Québécois celebrations. The PQ had just been returned to power after more than a decade, I think, out in the cold. Well, our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brûlé, has just popped into the studio. And Tyler, here we are, two Canadians looking back across the pond this evening.
Absolutely.
And what do you make of it?
It was extraordinary to wake up this morning and... I was somewhat surprised that the PQ got in. I really thought that the Liberals might sneak in again. So there was some surprise from that perspective. But I think just that to see real political violence and police and a body on the floor and an arrest at the same time, hand in hand, that was certainly the more shocking thing. This is not something you see in Canada.
And an Englishman saying in French, "The English are waking up." I think.
Exactly. Well, yeah, something to that effect. So, you know, and a number of things at play, because I think, you know, obviously it's no way to come to power. And you were talking about, you know, the PQ got in probably by about 0.7%, 0.5%. I mean, it's a tiny number. So they really, you know, they're properly a government, in a minority position. But I think to come into power now, also with this cloud of, what could have been an attempted assassination, we will find out as the investigation continues. But, you know, but nevertheless, certainly people shot and extreme violence around which was supposed to be celebration for them.
It's always dangerous at times like this when we're so close to the event and we don't know all the things we want to know about it to guess how much simmering underneath the surface there is in Quebec that we aren't in tune with or and should be.
Yes.
Do you have a
theaters? That, I think, you know, in this is one of the great things about Canada, but I think it's also one of the challenges for Canada as well. I think things often sit below the surface, and I think now we're seeing a number of things, come to the fore. There's been a surge in violence, in a number of Canadian cities. If we rewind a year ago, I mean, quite early on when we launched this, we did a story about Killer Peg, my hometown, one shouldn't laugh about a spike in homicide rates, but that is not the city that I lived in 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, things do change over the decades, but.
Well, and gun crime in Toronto and the outskirts of Toronto, shootings at malls and across streets,
exactly.
And random
those things, and then
gangs,
and again. We've also been talking about this as well. We had this murder in again going back to Montreal, a Chinese student found chopped up, global manhunt, and then of course then this gentleman arrested in Berlin, re-extradited back to Canada at enormous expense. Another Chinese woman also found chopped up and found in a river in Toronto. So all of these stories. Not great for brand Canada. I think this is one of the bigger issues, surrounding this. Canada over the last 6 months, when it's really been making headlines, has been for things which you would never traditionally associate with the country.
Yeah, and it's surprising some of the attention that story got, the man in Berlin arrest. I mean, it was just so, I guess, so horrible and ghoulish. This was body parts being posted around the country.
Correct.
So I guess it was bound to be picked up, but the mainstream media went for it here.
Yeah, and
like mad.
Yes, and it's the type of story that which international manhunt, and of course if this if the murderer or the accused certainly had a history of pornography and all kinds of things. It was just the type of thing, of course, south of the border that American networks loved, and it was one of those stories which went everywhere. But of course it became sort of a fourth or fifth item news piece in this country and elsewhere as well. I mean, it was a main story in Germany, obviously, where he was arrested.
And what have you? You've been peripatetic this summer, and it's good to see you again. How are you?
I'm very well. It's very nice to see you back in London.
It's lovely to be back off the farm. I mean, I've literally just finished the harvest.
Right.
And I feel like Farmer Durham's shown up in town, and it's...
And you would think that you would be, you look fine, but you would think you would be sort of, you know, suitably bronzed, but you're not.
Oh, you know, we cut our lavender. You can only harvest lavender when it's dry.
Right.
So we were cutting when it was dry for that afternoon or that morning, stacking it up, and then there I was sitting in the distillation stable, distilling this beautiful thing while the rain poured outside the window. So yeah, it was a really, you know, it was a bad summer, but the crop was great.
And everyone's been talking about what a great summer they've had in Canada.
If one more person tells me how warm and sunny and hot it is there.
It's fine. We're happier on this side of the Atlantic.
It's great. I'm very glad to see you.
Thank you, Nancy.
On the latest edition of The Menu, Monocle 24's weekly food and drink show, we speak to two top chefs. Spaniard José Pizarro, who's trying to prove to the world that there is a lot more to discover in Spanish cuisine. We also meet Andrew McLeish, the chef at Chapter One, a Michelin-starred restaurant hidden in the British countryside. We hear the latest on local coffee trends in Jerusalem, and we meet wine manufacturers of Livermore Valley in California, who are ready to challenge neighboring Napa Valley and the rest of the world with their products.
I'm looking to make something that's profound, something that's delicious, something that's age-worthy. I'm trying to make something that's going to be historically important, hopefully.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
The Toronto International Film Festival has elements of both and everything in between, and I've just gone ahead of myself there because I wanted to compare it to the film festivals of Venice, and here we are. We were talking earlier that Sundance is the festival for low-budget filmmakers, while Cannes and Venice are the glitzy industry showpieces, and then you might have guessed I meant to say that the Toronto International Film Festival is somewhere in between, but mostly, it's got to be said, it's a place for ordinary cinema lovers to see lots of great films. The 37th TIFF Festival kicks off tomorrow, and joining me on the line now from Toronto is Steve Gravestock. He's the senior programmer of the festival. Welcome, Steve.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. Hey, how's it going over there?
It's good. A bit frantic.
Okay, well, tell me why it's frantic.
Oh, it's just last-minute organizational stuff.
Yep.
Most of that's done, but sometimes there's... sometimes, you know, people forget things and they, you know, they're raised at the last minute and you try to do your best to accommodate them.
Like little details?
Mostly little details.
I was just trying to get you to tell us a good story if you had one there for us.
Oh, no. Some of it's shipping, and then it's like, when are people arriving at the theater? It's actually not that interesting.
Okay, well, let's...
just enough to make you panic a little.
Okay, well...
You know.
Okay, but interest...
But I'm prone to panicking.
Oh, yeah, I can identify with that. Tell me, I'd like to know about some of the highlights this year, and also what you, in particular, are looking forward to.
Well, we're opening with Looper this year. Tomorrow, the new film by Rian Johnson, who did Brick from a couple years ago.
Okay.
Which is actually one of my favorite American films of the last few years. It stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Bruce Willis, Emily Blunt, Jeff Daniels, Paul Dano, and Piper Perabo.
And what's it about, Looper? What's it about?
Well, it's a bit of a departure for us. It's kind of like a really smart science fiction movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's set in the 21st century, very much about time travel, which has been discovered but ruled illegal, and what kind of ensues from that. So it is a bit of a departure in terms of our opening night, because I don't think we've opened with the science fiction film before. But if you know Rian Johnson's films, they tend to kind of go off genre, so they usually invest it with elements that you wouldn't normally expect if somebody's sort of following those generic codes.
Neat. So
and
that's
a
departure.
Cool opener, I gotta say.
Good. And where's that going to be?
That will be at the Roy Thompson Hall, which is our biggest venue.
I know it.
It's a concert hall in downtown Toronto, which hosts the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, and usually, and also like a lot of concerts. It's about 2,000 seats, so it's a big hall.
And this is your 37th year. I don't want to talk about age, but. You know, I remember it getting off the ground. I can't believe that all these years have gone by. And you really do go from strength to strength. Is that right? That's my impression anyway.
Yeah, well, when it started, the original name for the festival was called Festival of Festivals, and it was perceived as sort of culling the best from the variety of festivals, you know, the film festivals that were around at the time.
Yes.
You know, the key players at that point would have been Cannes, Venice, and Berlin. Those would have been the biggest, the most prominent festivals, and things of course have changed radically since then, not just with TIFF but with the festival world. There's a lot more festivals now, and a lot more festivals that have certain themes, look at different types of films. We Toronto also hosts one of the largest documentary festivals in the world, and one of the most prominent hot docs, and there's a slew of other festivals that film festivals that occur in Toronto over the year.
So is that good news, or is that, you know, competition taking your people away?
Well, I think it's good news because, you know, it's always good that filmmakers have a venue to go to. It's tougher to distribute films now. Conventional means of distribution are, I wouldn't say, well the theatrical distribution isn't sort of the be-all and end-all that it used to be. Like, there's video on demand, there's a variety of different systems you can screen films on. So I think that the more the films are out there, I mean, to me, I still think the best way to see a movie is in a movie theater. It's going to be very hard to sway me from that. I think the more festivals there, the more, there's more opportunities for filmmakers to get their work out there. There's also more opportunities for them to hone their craft. They get to, you know, have exchanges with the public. So they can kind of see what's working, what's not working, and the way they approach their various, you know, subjects or projects. So I think ultimately it's a good thing.
What do you, if somebody's, you know, landed from another...
Of course, address
That's
the
okay.
other part of the question. Of course it's competition, but, you know, some competition is good.
Well, staying on that theme anyway, what do you think sets your festival apart from the myriad of other festivals? What's your special, should I use the word brand or...
Sure. Well, I think the major thing is that we are a public festival, and that's always been really one of the key things about TIFF. It started as a public festival. There wasn't a huge industry component when it began. It's driven by public box office. We have a very film savvy crowd here. It's a very multicultural city, so there's lots of different audiences to draw on who are interested in a wide variety of different things. I've told the year the World Trade Center, the 9/11 thing happened, we were actually on screen, and we had, all the planes stopped, everything was grounded, and we had a filmmaker from Albania his plane had to land in Halifax, which is on the far east coast of Canada, and he basically was stranded in Halifax for a couple days. We rearranged the schedule, to accommodate the screenings that we had to cancel, and he eventually made it to Toronto, but we were like, it was a long and obviously tragic week, and we didn't really know if anybody was going to show up to his film, and it was in a fairly large house on the final Saturday, and, I met him, and we walked into the theater, and it was jam-packed.
Oh, wonderful.
Primarily with Albanians.
Shumir, that means very good in Albanian, yeah.
And in fact, the volunteer translator had gone to kindergarten with the director. We've been a launching pad for all sorts of international cinema over the years. Piers Handling, our CEO and the co-director of the festival, programmed spotlights on two of the major. Three of the major international filmmakers in the early years. He did a spotlight on Pedro Almodovar before before his before he actually did a breakthrough in North America. So I think it was essential in getting, you know, spotlighting him or raising people's awareness of his work. And we also did a spotlight on Mika and Aki Kaurismäki, the I'd say the two most prominent Finnish directors. We actually have a new film by Mika this year called Road North.
Brilliant.
Which is a very cool comedy about fathers and sons. The son is a very prominent classical pianist, concert pianist, and his father, who disappeared when he was seven, suddenly shows up at his door.
Okay, I'm getting the signal that I have to wrap this up a little bit, but Road North, I want to see it. I like the way you're describing it. I'm going to let you get back to all those boring details so you can get on with the great show tomorrow night and wish you good luck.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve Gravestock from the Toronto International Film Festival.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobropa Jalavert, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Nelly Furtado and singing Turn Off the Lights. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London with me, Nancy Durham. Well, if India's Minister for Women has her way, the country's stay-at-home mums will be called house engineers, not housewives, and they'll get paid for their labor. Journalist Rahul Bedi joins us on the line from New Delhi. Now, hello.
Hi.
Where did this idea come from?
Well, it's an idea which is aimed at populism, because the Congress Party, which is in power and to which this minister belongs, is struggling. It's struggling under a whole range of scandals and corruption, and it's facing elections in another year and a half, and it's looking for votes, uh-huh. Basically.
And she wants to get the women's vote.
Yes, she's looking to get the women's vote, but it's a silly way of getting a women's vote because, firstly, she's talking about bringing legislation for husbands to pay their wives a salary, which is going to be determined by her ministry. That's a really silly idea because there have been so many legislations to deal either with children who are minors, who are employed in various factories and positions that they should not be. And also, for the last 20 years, they've been trying to reserve one third of seats in Parliament for women, and that hasn't come about. So I don't know how she's planning to implement this scheme of hers.
And I'm trying to picture how it could possibly be policed. Let's say this thing went ahead. How would you police a husband paying his wife, and how would that work? And would she have to ask him for raises now and then?
Well, it's impossible to work because given the social structure in India where wives are, to put it very simply, second-class citizens and treated as such by most men in this country. It's a male-dominated society, so it's going to be impossible to police, and hence it's a non-starter.
And there's a really serious story here, isn't there? The women work of women in India, I think, is really difficult. The average homemaker there, I'm sure, is taking longer to do her duties than, say, here in Britain, for argument's sake.
Yes, because she doesn't have the kind of implements that women in the West have. And she has to, especially in the villages, she has to do all the work in a lot of areas of India where the men don't go out and work. The women have to go out and work on the fields or take up employment or become laborers. So they have to not only be homemakers, but they also have to be home earners and wage earners. And I don't know how the minister plans on getting husbands to pay their wives. It really is a very bizarre idea.
Are people talking about it? Are women very vocal about this right now?
No, I mean, in fact, the minister, when she made this statement, said that it was aimed at empowering women. firstly, very few people know about the scheme that she's talked about, which is only about a day old, and nobody's talking about it. And again, it was she made this announcement in a small town in the north of India, which is the heart of male chauvinism. So I really don't see how this is going to be workable.
Do you know how it went down with the men then in the heart of male chauvinism in India?
I beg your pardon?
I wonder how the men reacted when she made this announcement in the chauvinistic...
Well, I belong to the fairly close to the place where she made this announcement, and I'm sure that it was greeted with a lot of mirth and laughter.
And sorry, I missed you there.
I said I come from a place fairly close to where she made the statement, and I'm quite familiar with the way the men and the males in that area think. And I'm sure her statement was greeted with a lot of mirth and laughter and incredulousness.
It certainly doesn't sound as if there's any chance of this law getting through.
Don't think, firstly, it's going to come to a law stage. I think it's going to remain an announcement that she's made, because it's impossible for her to get any kind of a bill through Parliament for this. So, as I said, they haven't been able to even reserve for the last 20 years a third of seats for women, because it keeps getting rolled back because no political party wants it. So I don't see how she's going to empower women by getting their husbands to pay for them.
Okay, we won't hold our breath over here, but thank you very much for telling us about this.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Raoul Bedi, journalist in New Delhi, was on the line with us. So that's all we have time for today. I want to thank our producer, Hannah Jenkins, researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Up next after the news is this week's episode of The Urbanist, the show about the cities we live in. In 3 hours' time, that'll be 2200 here in London, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson will be back for the Monocle Daily. And tomorrow evening, Hugo McDonald will be here with another edition of Midori House. I'm Nancy Durham. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.